This is Father Bonaventure Chapman.
And this is Father Gregory Pine.
Welcome to Godsplaining. Thanks to all those who support us. If you enjoy the show, please consider making a monthly or otherwise donation on Patreon. Be sure to like and subscribe to Godsplaining wherever you consume with your ears and your eyes podcasts. Father Gregory, here we are.
We are here, and it is us.
Mid-March.
Ish. Yeah, end of March, but it's not the last day of March. 20s
are still there, yeah, because March has somewhere between 30 and 31 days.
Somewhere between 30 and... So you got the first day of March, the last day of March, and then mid-March, based on your estimation.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, we're still within at least 10 days of the Ides of March, so we're still... So why, you know, I'm a generous, flexible guy.
We talk a lot about the Ides of March on account of Julius Caesar, but we don't talk as much about the Calends. That was an equally helpful term in reckoning dates in the oldie times.
What's Calends refer to?
I think it's the beginning days of the month. So, but I could be wrong. There's certainly going to be a scholar of classics who corrects us in the comments. But it is for this precise reason that we've come into the world to be corrected on such like things.
Well, and it's not just the Ides of the Ides of March, but the Ides of February.
Yeah, they're
Once
Ides.
Last year, said it.
Yeah.
Oh man, the Ides. I love the Ides of December. It's just after the St. John of the Cross's feast day. You know, a kind of thing. Or
you could say that.
Yeah, or Ides of February are right after Valentine's Day.
Right.
So, but no one really does Ides of July is a particularly good day because it's St. Bonaventure's feast day. It's
right.
The Ides of July, so I'm going to use that from now on.
If somebody were to send you a gift on St. Bonaventure's feast day, what would it be?
Oh, live toad.
Live toad. Okay. You heard it here first. His address is 487 Michigan Ave, Northeast Washington, D.C. 20017, live toads, thank you.
As many toads as possible. this should be a good point. Someone sent me a toad cup, which is very close to a live toad. I'm excited about. And if I could put a toad in that cup, you could have double toad power.
Wait, if you had a toad in a toad cup, do you realize that's like world ending?
Total victory.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like I would, world ends. Lord of the world.
It's
like
one of those paradigms where you go back in time and meet your grandfather and give him a high five.
Exactly.
Like if you put a toad in a toad cup, it's just...
So,
holy
folks,
smokes.
I have, because, and the person, that, thanks to the person who gave it to me, it has no name on it. So it was just like a delivered package.
An
and I couldn't even find
cup
the anonymous
package.
Toad cup. So the toad is there. The toad cup is there, I should say. It's just waiting, demanding.
To be filled with a toad.
Yeah, it's like
how big is the cup?
It's like the infinite
is it like
desire
a decent
of one's heart.
Cup,
oh,
is
it could
like
fit a real
cup?
Toad. Yeah.
Is it like a bowl? Because if it's a bowl, we're looking for a cane toad.
It's not
right?
a cane toad. No, it's general Buffo Americano.
Buffo Americano.
Yeah, yeah. It's a, but I mean, yeah, toad step. Oh my gosh, that's great. Focus. Focus. This
so
episode,
if you could train a toad to bring down the gifts at the offertory procession, would you?
No, it's a lizard thing.
Oh.
Because the problem is toads, they do walk. They do. But they also hop.
Yeah.
And that would just be too hard.
Right.
Whereas a lizard can scamper. You put a little harness on that sucker. And then you strap it. I've thought about this.
Quite naturally.
Like that.
How many morning meditations have you spent thinking about just such things?
Not in a while. Sure, in the student aid for sure. But once you kind of solve a problem, it's like 2 + 2 = 4. Like you're kind of done thinking about it.
Right.
Lizard with small carts. Because you can see it, like me, like getting them, organizing the cart with the lizard, and then like shooing it forward as everyone else just kind of like loses their mind. It would just be I think the Lord would delight in it so much before he struck the place with lightning.
Yeah, I think so.
You know what I'm talking about. Yeah.
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 Oh my gosh.
Oh, okay. All right, now that we've changed colors appropriately. Like lizards.
Oh my gosh. Woo. Ooh, I'm back. I'm back. I'm back.
So the episode is not nor will we mention them again in order that we can continue and carry on. The episode is not about reptilian and amphibian friends involved in liturgical moves. It's still a reminder about the toad cup waiting for the toad.
Oh yeah.
The episode.
Yep.
This is one of our literature episodes.
It is one of our literature episodes.
Which is one of our favorites. And we're going to be doing George Orwell.
Right.
But before I thought we just there's so much to say about him, so it doesn't matter if we say much about him.
Uh-huh.
We'll just say, when was the first time, do you remember the first book that you read and thought, wait a minute, like when you realized that there were different kinds of books, you thought initially books had words in them, they're all the same, but then you read one and you realized, wait a minute, this is actually literature.
Yeah.
And other things are other kinds of books. They're actually different. And these are really great. So do you remember the first book you read that you thought, wait a minute, this is not like other books?
So here's the thing. We were assigned all kinds of things to read in school, but we were also immature and we didn't care about the various jewels which were being tossed at our feet because we were, comparatively speaking, swine.
Kids.
And so I remember having like great expectations assigned to me in eighth grade by Mrs. Liddy and not appreciating it and thinking myself superior to Charles Dickens. Turns out I was wrong. And then in ninth grade, I remember in Mrs. Weber's class having Animal Farm assigned to me and me not appreciating it. Like, the pigs are standing. Holy smokes. What sweet allegory. So I dismissed Orwell on account of that. But then I came back to him later in Formation and read Homage to Catalonia.
Yes.
And I was like, this is a heady wine. Because while I don't necessarily agree with the action steps taken, namely fighting in the Spanish Civil War, the diagnosis is so keen, so perceptive, that it's kind of intoxicating.
Yeah.
Because, when it comes to diagnosis, he is fantastic. When it comes to prognosis, he's weird. But the capacity to observe, right, to perceive, and then to project with this kind of demagogical force is impressive. And that is what first kind of got me.
So Orwell actually might have had a sense of getting you first set up in literature.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. You were asking the question about literature in general. I don't remember.
Okay.
But certainly, like, reading prose like Hemingway, Orwell, like those hard-hitting, somewhat terse, very attentive to the shape of language, and being especially careful not to do it floridly.
Yeah.
That's like, that's one of the things that first really impressed me about the author's vocation or gift.
Yeah, that's great. I was in sophomore year, no, junior year with Mr. Sturm, I think it was. No, he was senior year. Darn, it was a little shorter man who was the junior teacher.
It'll come back to me.
Bald, had glasses. Darn, what was his name? He was great. He gave us the first quiz on something and like asked for specific details about a particular story, and everyone got like a zero on the quiz. And he just said, saddle up, boys. This is not your normal rodeo.
Yeah.
And so took like literature seriously. And we read in their Tale of Two Cities, which Charles Dickens. And I realized this was a different book.
Yeah.
I was a junior. I'd read plenty of books beforehand. You had to read in freshman and sophomore year and eighth grade, Shane, whatever. But again, you didn't appreciate it. It's a bit, which is not to say you shouldn't. I mean, I think people just need to do this, because you do. It's like why you take kids to museums, art galleries, and museums, to get them warmed up to it in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, you can't expect them to go around for 2 or 3 hours in there, but to get them a sense of this. So, but it was in junior year with Mr. That guy.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Maybe he's watching. Fill in. It was Kenmore Middle School. Nope. It was St. Joe's College High School.
Yeah.
He was this junior high school English teacher in 1990, what would that have been?
8-9.
8-9 or something around there.
Yeah, so if you know who that was, please put it in the comments. Thank
or something,
you.
Yeah. Okay, so anyway, that's great. He'll probably come back to me. But
apropos of that theme, I do remember when I started liking reading.
Oh, yeah.
When I started to like reading, whatever one would say normally. I was 19 because I really didn't like English class too terribly. I had some great English teachers in high school. But I really didn't like English class because I was a brat. So I took a poetry class at the community college the summer after my junior year so I could skip singular English and double up on, science.
Yeah, real stuff.
The real stuff.
Yeah.
And then I somehow found myself in the honors program at Steubenville because it was like, let's read great books and see how this goes. And then it wasn't that good, or at least my experience of it wasn't that good. It was well taught and the other students were very capable, but I was a brat again.
Yeah.
But then it was the summer after that year where I started reading books with some interest, with some panache, and that was also the summer that I got excited about becoming a Dominican, so
Seems
like books lay in the cards, or the cards were, in fact,
literature
books.
Brought you to Thomas Aquinas,
all the books are cards.
Who knows?
Yep.
Our conversion story is like an evangelical, can be described in many different ways. So let's go to George Orwell, then, so we talked about a little general. Orwell, a sort of manly writer, but different than Hemingway.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So just some biographical details. 1903 to 1950, Eric Arthur Blair, his real name, I guess.
Fascinating.
Yeah, who knew?
Cool.
Wikipedia did. So 1903 to 1950, so that's 47 years, not an old man.
Yep.
Right, well-trained, went to Eton, so had a decent background. Served in India as like a sub police officer or something. And he has an incredible, one of my favorite stories. When I taught business ethics, I would use his essay called on shooting an elephant. I think it's called on shooting an elephant. And it's just fantastic, really fantastic. But then, as a high school teacher, Spanish Civil War volunteer for the wrong side, it seems. Debatable. And then worked in the censorship department, which is fascinating, considering the books he wrote. And then writer critic, known for writing book reviews, a lot of things like this. Great, wrote novels and essays, so nonfiction essays. Some of the best in the English language, I think. He's really precise and uses English language in the way that ought to be used. Ambrose Bierce, I think, owns short stories. Like, he just nailed down short stories. And I always felt Orwell, when you read his essays, it's a bit like David Foster Wallace, although the exact opposite of style of English. Fascinating. But you read this and you feel like this man has a command of his genre. So that's Orwell's kind of experience. The novels, of course, Animal Farm in 1984 are most well known. His nonfiction accounts, you could say Amish to Catalonia. And then what's the other?
Road to Wigan Pier, Down and Out in Paris and London.
It's his first one, I think, actually. Road to Wigan Pier.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, and others besides, but those would be the big ones.
That's right. And he has an essay on Reflections on Toads, which I will now read the very first line.
Yeah.
Before the swallow, before the daffodil, and not much later than the snowdrop, the common toad salutes the coming of spring after his own fashion. Fascinating. That's just absolutely fantastic. One more line. After he comes out, at this period, after his long fast, he's burrowing from the hole, the toad has a very spiritual look, like a strict Anglo-Catholic towards the end of Lent. That is fantastic.
It's good prose.
The imagery is beautiful. But before we get into specifics, we want to talk about 1984. I think that's just one of his best. Very similar to Brave New World, which is an exceptional work. Some themes, maybe some overarching themes. I have some thoughts. You have some thoughts, I'm sure. What did you get if someone said, what's Orwell's shtick? Like, what does he really care about in some broadest terms?
Yeah, so it's fascinating. You observe this in various fashions, or you observe this in his various works, specifically Road to Wigan Pier, Down and Out in Paris and London, and Homage to Catalonia. He's a early 20th century liberal in the classic sense, like, you know, let them eat kink. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But like, you probably heard it said, if you're not a liberal before the age of 30, you don't have a heart. And if you're still a liberal after the age of 30, you don't have a head. He's one of these guys who has both heart and head, and he drives them both to their kind of conclusion. And so he thinks, like, he reasons, but he also loves, that is to say, kind of tends with a certain tenacity. And so there's his arguments have teeth, and his affections have force. Like, it's all very much intense. Yeah. And you get that, like, he's willing to undertake any number of sociological experiments because he believes in them. He's not just reporting on them so he can make money on them, although that is incidental to the craft. But he's willing to express himself in terms of a really profound solidarity with those whom he thinks are passed over or otherwise ground down. So, like, Down and Out in Paris and London, he tramps for a while, like the classic sense of tramping. Like, he goes from town to town and gets odd jobs, basically lives out of a suitcase. And then in Paris, he works in these terrible restaurants and the most menial of jobs, or he performs the most menial of tasks so that he can experience life at the brink of indigence, at the brink of destitution. And he can shine the light on that. And then with Homage to Catalonia, he really cares about, on the one hand, the anarchists, but then he ends up with the POUM or whatever it is, you know, more communist, who are against the fascists at this point, and everyone is in the wrong, it seems, in the conflict which he describes. But he also, in a kind of All Quiet on the Western Front type way, shows the futility of it, even while commending ideologically the purpose of it. It's like there's a real honesty before before the thing itself. And so when you have these types of descriptions in the background, so Down and Out in Paris and London, Road to Wigan Pier, Homage to Catalonia, and then you approach his fiction. We didn't mention Burmese Days or Coming Up for Air, which aren't as well formulated or as well kind of refined as Animal Farm or 1984. But you see what the ideological commitments can, like, how they can take shape in narrative or allegorical form. And so, yeah, there's a real intensity to it. There's a real tenacity to it, which I love.
Yeah, to me, the in which this piggybacks on what you're saying, pun intended, is the sense of truth at all costs, in a way. Like, he cares, and he's not afraid to say what is true, even if it hurts him. Like in the essay on shooting an elephant. I mean, the essay comes down to basically he's done this horrible deed of actually he doesn't think he needs to shoot an elephant that's on the run here, but he does it because he says that I had to do something so that no one would laugh at me like being made a fool of was actually more important. And you could imagine someone saying this and trying to get applause from the crowd or sympathy and all this. And this is, and we all feel like, oh, he said something, we all feel the same way, or now he's admitted that the weakness. But actually you just get, he honestly believes that, yeah, I was actually a coward. And this is just worth saying because maybe other people are cowards too. And we all need to acknowledge this. Otherwise, we're going to do horrible things. We're going to be moved around by forces that are not under our control and that ought not to be in control of us. So the honesty, regardless of the situation, the kind of gritty honesty and truth, no matter what, I respect that. And you just don't see that in a lot of writing. The other thing is the emphasis on the concrete, both in the in his nonfiction writing, like he has this beautiful thing on the politics of the English language, mm-hmm. which is a great essay, not only because it gives tips on how to write well, but also the importance of writing, about truth-telling and how language shapes thought, but not in abstraction. You can easily imagine this is, becomes some abstract comment about language and the world and our relationship and hermeneutics and all of these kind of things. But he refuses to go to these things. He sticks in the concrete. And he uses examples, he's always using vivid, concrete illustrations. And he makes clear that if you're going to be a good writer, you have to be a good thinker. And by being a good thinker, that means not moving to abstractions, but sitting in the actual images. There's almost a sense in which is, before you write anything, you have to see and feel the reality you're talking about. Otherwise, you're not expressing anything. You're just saying words. There's this, as you mentioned, he was a classical liberal, in the best sense of this word, of like the individualism and autonomy, but also just the laissez-faire focus on the personal goods and this sort of thing, private goods and all of this, a sort of liberal democracy as we get it today. And you get a sense that he just hates having other people tell him what he ought to do, just hates it. And so whether it's fascism or Nazism or communism, or totalitarianism in any form, it permeates, it seems, not only his like political writings, which we get into in a second, but also just his prose. He makes very clear, like, I don't want to use shop-worn phrases or other things because that's not actually me. That's just me falling into the herd and mm-hmm. having a passive sense of other people speaking through me, as opposed to my own voice, which has to be something from me that I've seen and experienced, not just in the world, but actually like internally. You just get the sense of this vivid imagination that has almost, you could touch and taste and smell and feel the things that he's going to then say in the English language. So there's this refusal to move to the abstract and the disinterested, but to stay in this tense, concrete, realistic perspective that doesn't use Latinate phrases and such unless they're absolutely necessary.
No, and I think that's another reason why he's an especially good writer in the English language, right? Or an especially good English writer, because he capitalizes on certain aspects of the English language which conduce to this type of communication. Like there's a kind of thwap to Anglo-Saxon prose, which is not diluted, but is softened by the Latinic kind of introduction that comes by way of France and the Normans and others besides. But there's, you get the feel for like the Angles, the Saxons, the Jutes, the Celts, you know, like in the crunch that the language can communicate. And it also bears the irascibility of the author in his particular case.
Yeah.
Because he's quoted as saying, in order to be a good writer, you need to wake up angry every morning. Mm-hmm. You know, so like you need to be able to register the incongruity of the injustice that you suffer. And then you need to contend with that via the only instruments which lie at your disposal, and in his case as an author, those are words, right? Words, phrases, sentence, paragraphs, whatever, complete things. And so there's a kind, again, we've mentioned like intensity and tenacity, but there's a kind of aggression even with his prosody. Whilst it's still beautiful, right? It has a kind of wonderful quality to it. Yet you get the impression that it's carried on with a kind of, you know, vehemence and vociferousness, which commend it to your listening.
Yeah, and it's the Latinate thing. It's so easy to think that, and the passive voice. You know, mm-hmm. don't use Latinate words unless you have to, and don't use the passive voice unless absolutely necessary.
Yeah.
And that's the killing both those. I remember Jonathan Bennett, a philosophical writer, pointed the same thing out about the Latinate and said just never use Latinate words. If you can get away with good old Anglo-Saxon words, because they're much more powerful, don't say it's possible, say can.
Mm-hmm.
Don't say it's necessary, say must. Mm-hmm. Or if it's moral necessity, we have an English word, like this beautiful Anglo-Saxon word that covers moral, it's morally necessary. In Latin, you have this long phrase for this, but you just say ought. Mm-hmm. You ought, I ought to do this. This ought to be done. As a ought is my favorite, I think, word in the English language. I just love it. It's fantastic. And you can imagine why.
No surprise.
Yeah, no surprise. But so it's really, and that politics of the English language is a beautiful essay if anyone wants to look at this. And it's available. Common Toads are good too. But let's do the novels, because these were things that you read. So I was just thinking about this, reflecting this last year or so, that in high school we read Orwell and Huxley, the kind of anti-totalitarian, anti-communist literature, right? So Brave New World or Ray Bradbury Fahrenheit 451 or Animal Farm or 1984 with George Orwell. There was mm-hmm. a sense that it was a holdover, I think, from the post-Soviet, the kind of Soviet Union reading list, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if perhaps in the early 2000s or 2010s, if that literature wasn't valuable anymore because of what, you know, Soviet Union was down, blah, blah, blah. And even before the late unpleasantness in Ukraine, still going on, I thought to myself, you know, actually, the totalitarian novels, this kind of fiction might be more important than ever, I think. But we'll save that, why that might be the case, at the very end. Mention first 1984 and mm-hmm. Brave New World, 1984 and Animal Farm. Both these novels are intending to deal with the totalitarian system. Animal Farm, which was, I think, rejected by T.S. Eliot initially. It was his first work, and T.S. Eliot rejected it from publishing, but said it could be published somewhere else, perhaps, from his firm. This beautiful little letter from him. But these two are anti-totalitarianisms. You want to take us through just the broad sweep of these things? Maybe just briefly on Animal Farm, people might be familiar, and then 1984.
I don't know Animal Farm as well as 1984, because I read 1984 more recently.
Okay.
So I'll do that one and then I'll send it back to you for Animal Farm. But 1984 breaks down to the three main sections. The first section is what everyone thinks of when they think of 1984, which is like censorship and newspeak and, you know, like the war that's been raging between Eurasia and Oceania since time immemorial. And you get the sense of the top-down dictation of the terms of human existence from this world state, which is what everyone thinks of, and justly so. But then the middle two, or yeah, like 100 pages, are an extended description of a romantic encounter mm-hmm. In very intimate detail, which is kind of distressing. As a means of escape.
Yeah,
you can basically skip it. But like, it's as a means of escape from the perceived oppression, which has invaded every aspect of the protagonist's life.
Yeah.
And then the final 100 pages is just an extended scene of torture, which ends with a rat helmet.
But not the Rocket Man.
But the Rocket Man, yeah, right. So an mm-hmm. extended scene of torture, which shows the lengths to which the state will go or might go in order to assimilate you if you should try to step outside of its omnicompetent grasp. Yeah. And so it gives you different vantages on, one, the regime, two, the rejection, and then three, the retrieval of those apostate sons.
There's so much to say, but let's just stick to 1984 then. And again, it's very similar, because the end of Brave New World, of course, has this discussion with Mustafa Mond and like the head totalitarian guy. And that last third of 1984 is with one of the Grand Inquisitors, you could say. Won't give away the total ending. And it's very wordy. But it's very also concrete. Again, with Orwell, you could imagine a conversation between two men about, you know, what it means to be in a government and what it means to be under rule of a totalitarian dictator, and all this could sound a bit forced. But instead, it feels very lively and really, I mean, there's existential sort of thing. Like, it's gripping. It's mm-hmm. absolutely gripping, those conversations. But another thing about Orwell, which I think becomes important, is he has the regime itself, this is in the first part where it's introduced, has command of the language.
Mm-hmm.
Like, knowing, so language and history.
Yeah, yeah.
The kind of, bizarrely enough, the things that you never think were important for control. You know, you think it'd be something like weapons and machinery and means of production, the capitalist kind of thing. But it turns out it's language and history that matters most for controlling how you engage in the world. And newspeak mm-hmm. is the kind of vocabulary. And all these words that, it's funny, I want to ask you what you think about this. It's not like Animal Farm where it's comical, like talking pigs, but you get the sense of actual, like, these words you would never actually imagine doing, right? A doublethink, newspeak, you know, this big brother, they seem so silly. But I think that's part of it is that actually, if someone continues to force upon you a particular language and particular words, you actually might start adopting those silly phrases silly words. And so it has this performative action to it. And the double think of you can say this and then this and totally different, and newspeak, how you adjust how you deploy things to explain events to actually, it's so relevant. Mm-hmm. I mean, but to see it in actual print in here and the kind of bold colors, almost like a kid's version of it, it looks like. It feels kind of like a kid's book at a certain point, but I think part of the goal is to show that, yeah, civilizations that act like this are children's civilizations. They're not really serious.
Yeah. It's funny, like, I mean, just to kind of skip to the comparison between Orwell and Huxley as to who was right about modernity. I mean, they're going to be right to varying degrees depending upon the particular time and place and circumstances. But I think they're both right, right? Huxley's insight is, you know, his big thing is soma, right? Just give them something that pleasures them and they will pleasure themselves out of existence, in effect, or they'll pleasure themselves out of genuine opposition to the regime. Whereas Orwell, he seems to be more in the kind of top-down camp, and he thinks that a lot of these things will be imposed by control over language and history. If you can control the narrative, mm-hmm. both in its vocabulary and grammar, and then the unfolding thereof, as well as its temporal dispensation, then you can control this people to think according to, you know, your preconceived notion as to what should arise. But what we find in the 21st century is that we give people the pleasure kind of factor. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily soma so much as it is. Well, I mean, there's like plenty to be said about like drugs and alcohol and things there. But right now it seems like social media is the big one. So you give people the means whereby to pleasure themselves out of existence, truth be told. Yeah. And they actually become the purveyors of the newspeak and the rewriting of the narrative. So it doesn't require much in the way of top-down. I mean, maybe there is some top-down stuff going on that's very nefarious, and I have not observed it because I'm too, just out of touch.
Oblivious.
Yeah, oblivious, sure. But I suspect that a lot of this is just by, one, hyper-pleasure, and then mass manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
So they're both right.
Yeah, it's interesting that you would have, who knew they were actually together? It's a bit like, I always think that Marx ends up being right about how the society is going to develop, where capitalism will be overthrown at some point by this bizarre technologization of everything, such that we'll have just tons of free time. And he just didn't know it was AI. Who knew that this was going to actually do this? But who knew that both Huxley, that these could be combined, that the language issues and structuring how we can perceive of the world through short videos and reframing and blah, 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 would actually come through this kind of addictive, mind-numbing experience. Because maybe I'm the only one who has experience, but like if I'm watching a few videos, even if they're good videos like SNL or something, or whatever, good, you know, kind of funny videos or something, after watching a few of those things and I think, my gosh, I could have been reading Orwell or something else, you just feel like I'm dumber because of that. And yet it's such an easy sort of pleasure. This is TV in general. Mm-hmm. We don't have TVs here. We don't do TVs. Our house doesn't have a TV, but I've got one in my pocket. You know, mm-hmm. So you've always got this pressure. And I think the other aspect here is that it's actually the herd versus the individual that he hits on. You think it might be in 1984 and his other works, the authoritarianism versus democracy or something. But it seems like underneath that is the deeper issue of the herd mentality of being passive to others and the individualistic attitude of actually being yourself, like having creative power, owning your life and intending to live your life in a particular way. And I think that Orwell, over and over again, no matter what he's doing, it seems is to saying you can be an individual and you ought to be. You're a human being and you ought to steer your life according to particular dictates that you have not come up with, but that you've embraced for your own reasons. And you're not just like going along with the flow. I think this strikes us as, you know, as Catholics, I think sometimes this could be a little, we could be upset. Oh no, we're supposed to go along with the flow. I mean, it was, of course, with the church teachings and all this stuff. And so we are a church, an ecclesia. But at the same time, it could be perhaps seen as the model of the saints who live within that language, the shared language that we're given, but have their own spectacular individuality and their own way of incarnating or embodying, is maybe better, the universal messages of Christ's love. since the obviously Christ himself is infinite as the God-man, and there's more, always more that you could say. So I'm going to open up for a second here to you for some theological reflection on the individuality versus the herd thing and what we might take from, is Orwell, I mean, am I off base in saying that maybe there is an individuality aspect that we Catholics should be attentive to and it's not just a political matter that we're worried about here?
Yeah, I think there's maybe the language that I would use is, are you meant to be assimilated or are you meant to be dignified? Mm. So there's a sense in which Orwell highlights the assimilative force of the polity, especially if that polity is manipulated by bad governors or by tyrannical regimes. And the question is, do you have the habits of mind and heart which help you to resist a false assimilation by means of fear, coercion, passion, ignorance, whatever else? Or is there something else, you know, like more noble going there? So not just being assimilated, but rather being dignified in your expression of your humanity, not just as a radical individualist who's going mm-hmm. to set out in whatever direction you determine based on your own autonomy, but as one who has a genuine sense of who you are and what you're for within the setting of the polity, within the setting of the church, you know, in conversation with God and in, you know, genuine subjection to the law, to the legitimate regime, so that all can be in turn kind of built up by and dignified by the experience. And so I think that, you know, Orwell, by his own lights, has some keen insights, but because he doesn't have the whole picture, it doesn't choose to have the whole picture or submit to the whole picture, that you're going to get particular expressions sure. which are kind of, you know, rough around the edges or a little bit intense.
Yes,
I will. But I think that we can bring it to perfection by our reading thereof.
Yeah.
Ready.
We will bring it to perfection this episode by the reading thereof.
Let's go.
One of my favorite, this is the end, this is part three with the Inquisitor, shall we say. I won't give his name away because then it kind of destroys part of the book. But there's this great line where the main protagonist is asking, Winston is talking back, this is during the torture kind of scene, the reprogramming, you could say. And the Inquisitor says, if you want a picture of the future, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever. And there's something so vivid about that. And this is the thing with Orwell, is all his writing strikes me, is it hits you so hard,
mm-hmm.
and then you think, no, that's crazy. That's too, like, newspeak, doublethink. You know, boot on the face, stepping on the face, on the human face forever. Like, this is just absurd. But I think his point is to say, it's literally, this will happen. You can make this happen. Like, this is a human problem of wanting to be ruled and stamped on. And you just don't know how far you've let this go. And it is, yeah, it's salubrious to me, especially today, because it's just easy to let, you know, to be controlled by others, as opposed to have a control of your own dignity and your relationship with God as not and in as you ought to be, as opposed to just saying what everyone else says. I mean, there's sometimes that you should say what other people say, but so often today we just take the easy route out. And he's just, his maybe too far focus on individualism does remind us that it is easy to be passive, not only in our writing style, but also in like our living sometimes. Any final thoughts on George Orwell, a particular image of his or phrase that has always struck you or stayed with you?
Yeah, I would say that George Orwell helps me in this meditation that we entertain sometimes on these episodes. Like, you don't read a particular author because he necessarily draws the right conclusions. Sometimes it's fruitful to read a particular author because he asks interesting questions and he pursues that line of interrogation in an interesting fashion. And I think that can help us to engage our humanity, engage the realities at stake well, right? In a way that leads to blessedness. So I think that that's where, like, St. Thomas Aquinas would say, any truth by whomever mm-hmm. spoken is spoken by the Holy Spirit, quoting St. Ambrose. So that you have some really keen insights, some really good diagnosis, not as good on the prognosis piece, but, like, you know, can we fault him given time and place and circumstances? But certainly I've profited from it, and maybe some of our listeners will profit from him too.
Yeah, especially just the language.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, that's it for us, folks. Thanks for listening to this episode of Godsplaining. Follow us on Facebook, X, Instagram, like, subscribe, leave a 5-star review if you'd like to donate to the podcast. Do so through Patreon. You can follow the link in the description. Also, you can find there a link to Godsplaining merchandise and our website, which has upcoming events and other details. The one thing we want to mention on this podcast is, and we've mentioned this before, the retreat in Malvern this summer, June 7th through 9th. We don't do an all-comers versus a young adults retreat anymore. We just do the retreat. So you're all are welcome to the retreat, Malvern, Pennsylvania. Beautiful retreat house from June 7th through 9th. So we'd love to see you there. That's it for us. We'll be praying for you. Please pray for us. And we'll catch you next time on God's Plan.